evening, and welcome to Good Evening, the Alfred Hitchcock Podcast. I'm your host, Brandon Shea Mutella. Joining me, as always, is my ever-constant co-hosts, Tom Caldwell and Chris Haig. Chris, you know what, Chris? It's lovely to see you. Lovely, 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 lovely to see you.
You said something really nice. It's one of the creepiest compliments ever. And I'm like, that's kind of a testament to the show, really, isn't it? And they're like, yes. There are certain words I can't unthink of. Just lovely.
Yes. God. Oh, it's nice just lovely to see you. Just lovely. Tom, how are you doing, my friend? Tom, that is a beautiful necktie.
Well, thank you. I have a lot of... I somehow keep losing them. But uh-oh. I have a closet full of neckties, and I try to look dapper every day. Do you like my monogram pin on my lapel is another accessory I like to wear.
Would you have a T or a C?
I would have the letter C, I think, is the formal.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Sounds good. Excellent. Right on. Well, we are going to be talking about the Grandmaster's second last film. What do they call it? Do they have a word for that? Sophomore? Or, no, sophomore is like your...
Penultimate.
Second film. Penultimate. There we go. That's a good word. Penultimate. Now we sound fancy. Penultimate film, Frenzy. And we have actually got ourselves a special guest, Michael Bailey, all the way from England. Chris, I don't know what's going on here. Like, just like the Beatles, this is the British invasion here.
Listen, I'm just thrilled for once, I get to have someone in the corner with me against the North Americans, so I'm thrilled.
It's probably a good thing that we have another Brit talking about Hitchcock, because, you know, he's from Britain originally, right? So.
Well, yeah, and this is a very British film we are covering, which is a bit of a change from lot of the European and US-centric films. So, yeah, it's a bit of a nice change of pace.
Awesome. Well, welcome, Michael. Thank you. Please sit down at this table here. I've got a delicious meal for you of fried alley cat.
Oh, I was hoping it would be some quail with grapes.
Quail with grapes. No, I'm fresh out of grapes today. So, fresh out of quail, so as well. But anywho, excellent. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm having a real fangirl moment. And it's great to be on the podcast with the best theme music as well.
Oh, isn't right. that a great song?
It's a great theme song.
Jason's amazing. I love it. I never get tired of it. Like, no matter how often I hear it, I never get tired
of it.
It's so
good.
I'm so sad because he used to live in Regina and he moved off to Toronto, so I don't get to see him like I used to. But not that I saw him a lot, but it's still, he's not there. I can't just call him up anymore and play a board game. So, anyways, Michael, tell us a little bit about yourself. Tell us a little bit about your Hitchcock fandom and tell us a bit about your podcast that you've got.
So I'm a performer and I also have a podcast called Twice Nightly, which is all about variety theatre in the UK. Looking at the history of that and some of the people and some of the weird and wonderful stuff that went on kind of way back from the 1800s all the way up to the present day. And I'm also a huge cinephile, massive, massive Hitchcock fan. Have been a massive Hitchcock fan since I was about 12, I would say. I would say from about the age of 12 onwards. And just
What was your first Hitchcock?
Psycho, like most people, I think.
Oh.
Psycho was the first one. It happened to be one of my mother's favourite films, quite ironically. And my grandparents used to talk about it all the time because they had been to see Psycho at the cinema when it first came out. So they always used to talk about it like it was this kind of lore. And they would always talk about the fact that people were screaming in the cinema and people were fainting in their seats. And as a kid, I was totally like bewitched of what is this film that made people react like this? So it always was like, it was like a carrot been dangled in front of me. And then when I finally saw it, it totally blew my mind. It really changed the way I watched film and it changed the way that I understood what film can do and what film can be. And yeah, I've been a Hitchcock addict ever since.
Is Frenzy your favorite? Because you reached out to us.
I would say Frenzy is second favorite. Psycho's always going to be my top. Okay. Psycho's always going to be number one. You always remember your first.
Okay.
But yes, Frenzy is definitely... second favorite.
Wow.
Yeah.
Interesting.
They were big words.
Mm-hmm. I don't, like, this is not generally considered one of his best.
No, it's not. It's a controversial opinion. But I feel like Mm-hmm. All of my opinions of Hitchcock's later films are all quite controversial.
So I take it that means you like Topaz?
I really like Topaz. This is probably the most controversial one. I absolutely really, really love Topaz. This is where so many of your listeners have just switched off now. They're like, I'm not listening to this guy.
No, I don't. You know what? We love contrary opinions here. I think everybody's nuts. Jamaica Inn is a masterpiece. I don't know why people hate that movie. I think it's fantastic. So,
do you want another controversial opinion?
100%.
I think I would put Family Plot in my top 10.
Okay.
That's very controversial.
I see, like, as I've said a few times over the last couple episodes, I mean, this is only the second time I've seen Frenzy, and I've only seen Family Plot once before, so this is all new to me, basically, because it's been so long since I've seen them. So I'm looking forward to getting to Family Plot.
I really do love Frenzy, because I think it feels like a real return to form. I think his last couple of films didn't live up to the standard that people were expecting at this point from Hitchcock, mm-hmm. and he kind of moved away from the espionage and went back to a good, juicy murder story, which is obviously what he does best. And I just love it. I think there's something so atmospheric about it. I think it's really different from some of his other films, but all the tropes are there. There's a lot of things in there that fit the Hitchcock film criteria that you could tick off, and it's great. And this is going to make me sound like a complete loser, but I always go on regular pilgrimages to the filming locations. If ever I'm in London, I always go to like the Frenzy filming locations.
Mm-hmm. Okay, excellent. You know, so I'm going to break form for this episode here because we've already got a good discussion going on. Normally we get to our behind the scenes trivia and our recap of the episode, but you know, you guys all know I just pull the information from Wikipedia anyways, and we just do a brief summary of the film. Let's just keep going on with the discussion of the film here, but I want to jump to Tom and ask him a question here first on this one, because Tom, what are your impressions of this film? Because last time when we discussed Topaz, you had said, you know, a lot of people think that Hitchcock's been dry, his love stories are very dry, it's like people don't even kiss and it's all boring and whatnot, and you're like, he's not even a modern movie maker and it's almost the 70s. And then here we go, we jump into this film, 1972, and we've got an R-rated film with nudity, somebody getting raped on screen, and like, this is a very, very different type of Hitchcock. Now, Tom, you were kind of asking for this last time. How does this film make you feel? What do you think of Frenzy for that?
It's interesting because when you realize he's competing with a lot of violent films of the era, Clockwork Orange being one of them. Yes, there's a lot of very revealing murder and rape and nudity in this film, but that is not the lovemaking that would have been present in the older films, right? The films of the 50s and 60s. Those were passionate, romantic relationships where this is murder and rape. Like, this is very violent film. Mm-hmm. So a lot of people say that Hitchcock finally is free of all the shackles of conformity and the restrictions of the censors of the older films, and he's able to be violent on screen and sexual on screen. But that's a different type of sexuality than what we discussed last time, where I was reading from a critic in Rolling Stone magazine saying that he felt there was no true sexuality in the romantic scenes. So it's two different things, but it is a definitely a big change from what we're used to in Hitchcock films, and I take it as a negative. Like, I find this film a little too violent, a little too sexual to be able to enjoy it as a standard format Hitchcock.
Mm-hmm. I'll get to some of what you said there, Tom, but Chris, let's get your initial impressions on this. Had you seen this one before?
So I watched this about a year or so before we initially started the podcast, and it was one of those where I was going through seeing like, oh, okay, I've seen that, that sounds interesting, and I came across Frenzy, and I'm someone who grew up in a household where there was a lot of murder mysteries, a lot of whodunits, a lot of darker sort of psychological thrillers, horrors, that sort of thing. So this really appealed to my particular wheelhouse, you know. And so when I watched it, I was like, oh, I really like this. I really enjoy this. Now, is it a bit of an outlier in Hitchcock? Well, it depends on how you look at it in terms of the historical context, because we're coming out of the 1960s where you have sort of post, you know, the initial bloom of true crime. So, you know, it's post In Cold Blood, it's post Truman Capote, and you're entering the 70s, which is, you know, like the Zodiac Killer and Ted Bundy and all this kind of stuff that's becoming far more widely known about. And it is, like James and like Tom have said, it is like this subversion of the dark, or a subversion of the tropes that Hitch is famous for. You have the innocent man who is wronged, you have, you know, a crime and he's on the run, and all these little tropes that he's had, but it's done to such a dark degree that it is, it's, I don't know if I'll put into the word, but it's quite jarring upon first watch. Mm-hmm. And if you didn't know it was a Hitchcock film, I don't think you would pick up on it. Like, there are certain things when you watch, like, a Hitch film, particularly from the 50s, when there's a bit more romance and glamour and, you know, a lack of shocking on-screen violence, that you would go, oh, okay, I can recognise this as a Hitch film. Whereas this feels far more of a isolated London thriller of the time. For me, though, I really enjoyed this. But again, like I said, that is playing to my specific wheelhouse as someone who grew up watching, and again, this is a really specific one for the UK people, but it was like when I was a young kid, like Messiah was a big thing, and the dark sort of murder mystery ritual procedurals were out. So this, you know, because for the first sort of, I don't even know if I'd say first half, but it's almost like the first third of the film, it's the necktie murderer, and mm-hmm. you don't know who he is, and then once that switch happens and you then start seeing it from his perspective, it then becomes a completely different beast. And I just, yeah, I personally really enjoyed it.
Mm-hmm. I really enjoyed this movie. Like I said, this is like a first time watch for me, because all I remembered was the tongue sticking out of the mouth from the to the dead bodies, right? And like I said last time, I think that that's really stupid, right? I don't like that. It is such a Hitchcock thing, though, right? Like it perfectly fits what Hitchcock would do. Okay, so like I don't like it, but it's him. Okay, but this movie just, it felt so weird because it feels like three movies, right? Because you do have the killings at the beginning, and then you've got this whole other story of this detective and his wife's food, and then you've got this other whole section of the actual killer going through the potato bags and whatnot. And it wraps up kind of suddenly, even though it's an almost two-hour film. So, like, I like it. There's a lot of good stuff in it, but it feels very strange for a Hitchcock film. And to me, the nudity really feels out of place in a Hitchcock film. Like, I feel like Hitchcock's my grandpa, right? He's that grandpa who tells those weird jokes all the time. And, you know, you're just like, that's who grandpa is. He tells these murder jokes, these dry humors. And I would feel super weird if I, like, opened a drawer and found my grandma's pornos. You know, and like that's what I feel like has happened here with this movie. It just feels very strange to me. So, and it's just because it's Hitchcock. You know, like if this had been any other director and not a frame was changed, I don't think I would feel weird about it. So, yeah, I don't know. But the other thing about this is the plot of this with the necktie murderer, like this film feels like it's come 40 years too late, or 35 years too late. Like, the necktie murderer. Oh, it's the necktie murderer. And you have that opening scene of everybody looking into the water. This feels like a scene ripped from a movie from the 30s. And this concept of the necktie murderer, you know, just totally feels like something from that era of filmmaking.
If you could rewrite the concept, it would be like, what, like a zip tie murderer, or the fat belt murderer, or... Like, it would be some kind of different strangulation, but not the formal necktie. Is that the idea?
The cravat killer.
Yeah, like, it's. I think just the idea of the neck timer, like a 70s film, like it shouldn't be strangulation, it should be like stabbing or something like that, you know? So it just feels like it's just been picked up, like an abandoned script from the late 30s or early 40s that's just, you know what, I've been dusted this one off here.
You're saying it should be set in a glamorous, high society, formal wear kind of environment.
No, not even that. It's just I don't know. Maybe it's me, and it's just something deep in my brain.
I think it feels like The Lodger. Don't you think it bookends The Lodger quite nicely? If you look at The Lodger from the start of his career, then look at Frenzy from the end. I think they bookend quite nicely.
Yeah,
a lot of critics write about that, and it's the serial killer. It's the Jack the Ripper, the gentleman killer idea, and that the comparison to The Lodger has been made. But you know, that's a very good comparison.
Michael, I take it that the nudity doesn't bother you.
No, it doesn't, actually. I remember the first time I ever saw Frenzy, actually, and it was, I got the VHS for my 13th birthday, because my parents did not care. And I put it on, like, there and then. It was the first thing I did. I put the VHS straight in, and I watched it. And I remember at the time being really, feeling really out of place. I remember feeling that it really was disturbing, and I wasn't quite sure how I felt about it. But I think over time I've really appreciated what it is, and I really do love it. And I think the nudity doesn't bother me, because like you say, when we were, it's moving in times where this was quite the commonplace in film now. And I think that, I don't know whether Hitchcock felt that he had to put it in to sort of try and keep up with other studio films at the time. I mean, he wasn't the type that would do that regularly, you know, that would just conform to what everybody else was doing. But I think that his defense of it would be that most of it, apart from that one scene in the hotel room, most of it is kind of in context. It's not just gratuitous nudity. Like, it is part of the murder stories and the rape theme. So it doesn't feel too out of place for me.
I don't think that it does either, but I think that, so my interpretation of it is that he is doing it to try and get caught up to the times, because his last two movies haven't been critical successes, right? And so, like, I don't read a ton of Hitchcock analysis by people. I don't read a ton of Hitchcock books or anything like that. But, I mean, I can picture a scene behind the scenes where Hitchcock's talking to Alma and is like, man, I don't know what's up. Have I lost my touch? Do I need to change the way I do things? Do I need to get more modern and whatnot? Maybe I need to spice it up a bit for the current audiences, because they don't appreciate that type of filmmaking anymore. Like, I can see that conversation happening. I don't know if it ever did or not, but that's how I interpreted this film watching it this time. When I went for lunch with Tom the other day, and when he told me there's nudity in this, I'm like, what are you talking about? Like, again, I couldn't believe it when Tom told me there was, because I haven't seen this in so long, I forgot all about it. But I'm like, Hitchcock? Nudity? What?
One of the, kind of on this concept of the serial killer, Hitchcock himself told a film school at University of Columbia in 1972 that he feels villains should be attractive men. Otherwise, they'd never get near their victims. If you look at most of your cultural murderers, they're rather gentlemanly sort of fellows. So our character, Bob Rusk. Now, I love the fact that Bob is a greengrocer, right? Because that's the Hitchcock family heritage. Hitchcock himself, his father, was a greengrocer. So I love that kickback. Because he could have cast Bob Rusk as a fishmonger or a butcher or a car dealer or, you know, all sorts of things. But the fact that he's a produce seller, I think, is a wonderful touchstone. But he's a very, for the fact that he's in a gritty warehouse environment with all these diesel trucks and men working and all this sweaty labor going on, he's a very dapper fellow. He's very well-dressed. He's wearing very nice suits every day. And that allows him, of course, to have the neckties and the lapel pin, the monogram pin, which becomes a big part of the storyline at one point. And so he's a very, I think maybe that's a little bit of classism and him bragging amongst his crew that he's the boss, he's the owner, he's the man with the money, that he can afford to dress up like that at a gritty, dirty kind of environment job. But he's a classy character. Like he comes across with the style that you would expect from that type of a killer. And his character, if his character was blue collar, white t-shirt, and a denim jacket, he wouldn't have had the charm, or we wouldn't have been as impressed by him on camera. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. I think so.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of that old statement, which is that, you know, the majority of serial killers and offenders out there are conventionally attractive, handsome, well-spoken, charming, all that kind of stuff, because otherwise no one would go with them. I mean, it's weird because, you know, we're living in a world where you've got Zac Efron playing Ted Bundy and Evan Peters being, you know, worshipped for playing Jeffrey Dahmer, but it is that kind of weird feeding into it factor where you've got, you know, this really handsome, smart, and you think he's going to be like the sidekick or the best friend to the main character, and then a third of the way in, it turns out that Rusk is, of course, the villain, the bad guy, in what is maybe one of the most harrowing scenes I've ever seen Hitch do. It's, I mean, like, silly tongue thing aside, it is genuinely scary and really unsettling. But in terms of the nudity and everything, I think it's part of a, you know, part of the cultural trend. I mean, I always think of it in terms of the Carry On films, which are, for anyone not in the UK, there are like these comedy farce films that are still on TV every bank holiday and everything. But the point is that, you know, they were around in the 50s and the 60s, and then as soon as they moved into the 70s, they then started experimenting with nudity and with more risque elements. So I think it's part of a wider cultural trend that I think Hitch might have wanted to jump on, not only because of the freedom, but also because it would maybe give him a bit of a boost, which, looking at the box office, I mean, it cost $2 million to make, and it got $12 million back, so...
It did okay.
It did not bad.
It did all right.
Yeah, this film definitely hits harder now, I think, in the, you know, the wake of the Me Too movement and whatnot. And listening to the characters talk, like, it was very well addressed, even in the 70s, where they're talking about how, like, you know, there's these men who have these desires, and you can tell that these are going to be bad people, and, you know, the women that are running the marriage, the dating site and whatnot, like having to get people's profiles and whatnot, like it feels very interesting listening to her secretary talk about men and listening to those hotel owners talk about men.
The matchmaking bureau thing is very hard to, like, hard for me to grasp, but yeah, that would have been a thing, a matchmaking bureau, like a dating service that's a physical brick and mortar store rather than a website, you know, like that's kind of a weird concept, but apparently it would have been a thing back then, right? And I think it's probably for, you know, decades and decades been a informal service that there would be friends, you know, hooking up friends or whatever. But the fact that it was a professional bureau where you could go and get lined up with a prospective mates was kind of an interesting concept. But yeah, it definitely allowed the character that went in there, when Rusk went in there as a client, tell me if I've got this wrong, and then he said, yeah, he's more into alternative sex or rough sex or whatever, and that's what got him pushed away from being a client of the dating bureau. Like, they didn't want to help him because they didn't appreciate. But that turned into evidence or reinforcement of the fact that he was the killer, because he had these alternative motives in the bedroom, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that in later years, and in a lot of hindsight, everybody uses the word misogyny when they talk about Hitchcock, and especially in this film, but even so at the time, people were complaining that it was misogynistic and the violence that there was, and that the, you know, the treatment of the women in this film, and the fact that they're only female victims. But watching it now, I think the female characters come across the best. I don't think any of the men are particularly likable in this film. I think the female characters are the strongest characters. They're the most warm, they're the most compassionate, and I think some of the performances by some of the actresses in this film are fantastic.
Brenda, despite becoming a victim of the murder and the like, as she did, is a business owner. She's in a successful boss of her company. She is the one that Richard comes to for help when he's out of money, when he's fired, when he's out on the street. She's the one offering him money, and she snuck money into his coat. Like, she's the power player in that relationship.
And even in Mr. and Mrs. Oxford, as much as he solves the case, she had it cracked way before he did.
Yeah. Yes, she did. So, to something that you said there, Michael, about how the men aren't very likable. Like, that's one of the other hurdles, I think, that this film has for me, is Blaney. The main character, yeah. Richard Blaney. Like, he's such an unlikable main character. Like, I don't like this guy. This guy's a dick, mm-hmm. right? You know, he's, I mean, like, I'm on the side of his boss at the bar. The guy's, you shouldn't be drinking at work. You're taking booze, okay? You're in the wrong here. That guy was totally justified in firing him, right? Mm-hmm. So, like, it's so weird to have a character who's your main character, who's the innocent man on the run that you don't like.
It is, but do you know, that's never bothered me because I think that adds an extra tension to it because you think when he mm-hmm. gets caught, because you know that at some point he's going to get caught, yeah. you know that it's kind of over for him before he's even had a chance to explain himself because everybody at this point knows that he's a bit rough, that he doesn't behave very well, that he's supposedly, you know, there's a divorce petition where he abused his wife. So you know that if he gets caught, the stakes are higher for him because nobody is going to believe that he didn't do this.
And being a fired bartender, you know, being unemployed, all that, like he's working as a bartender to begin with, which is a demotion for him. It's kind of the only job he could get. And all of that supports him as a criminal type. Like all of that, all of those things happening in his life lead, you know, towards that false conviction.
But it's quite interesting that he did make the wrong man this time rather than it being, you know, whether it's Henry Fonda in The Wrong Man or Cary Grant in North by Northwest, that he didn't make the innocent man on the run, this suave, likable hero. He actually made him a bit of a loser.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's an interesting point because it is almost like a dark subversion of his own tropes, which I think is such a cool beat to go on, which is, you know, you've got the hero, but he's incredibly unlikable. He's mentioned that he was an airman in World War II, so there could be some post-traumatic thing going on that unfortunately is never explained. You have the, you know, in a different version, Babs, played by Anna Massey, who, I love Anna Massey, I think she's got, well, had one of the best voices. In another version of the story, she's the heroine, and unfortunately she doesn't make it out, and I'm like, oh, shame, Babs was really nice. But then you have, there's no big reveal at the end. It's all this really dark take on the wrong man story because up until a certain stage, you are not sure that he isn't a killer and we're not just following his perspective. You know, until Rusk reveals himself, there is these string of murders and it's like, oh God, this could actually be it. We could be watching our protagonist, who is both the antagonist and the protagonist, mm-hmm. do something really, you know, villainous and we're just sort of along for the ride. Yeah. My only other aside is I'm complete agreement with Michael in the sense of I would watch a show which is just Mrs. Oxford going around making the world's most awful food and solving crimes.
It's like she's in a film completely of her own. She's in this complete separate world where she just kind of breezes in and breezes out.
But that's what I love, in that she's cooking this awful rubbish food, but then every so often, because she slips in, she's like, oh, she's just very quietly solving the case, going, well, that doesn't make much sense, does it? And that doesn't make much sense. And it's all this, you know, quote unquote feminine intuition. And I'm like, my God, I mean, get you out of the kitchen and get you, you know, on the streets.
Yes. But she is one
get
of
you solving crime.
She is one of the standouts. I think there are three real standout yeah. female performances in Frenzy, and I think the first one is Mrs. Mm. Oxford. Vivian Merchant is Mrs. Oxford, who is just brilliant. Yeah. Like we say, because she is almost in a separate movie. She's in this completely other world. And she brings that real level of comedy to the film, which obviously Hitchcock really appreciated all through his career, but it's really evident in that character and in Frenzy. Also, Billy Whitelaw as Hetty Porter, like that, to me, that is a character that really kind of, when you look at it as a whole, that character doesn't really need to be there. She's only in a few scenes, and she's there to maybe add a little bit of tension to the fact that he's hiding at their apartment and she doesn't like him. But in that, you know, I suppose we're supposed to feel that she should be scared because, as far as she knows, she's sharing an apartment with a murderer. But I'm more scared for him in those scenes because she is terrifying. She is so... Yeah. And the way she speaks to him and the way she delivers her lines, it's so venomous, and you can feel the hatred, and she really fleshes out a very, very small part, which I think is brilliant. But for me, the standout performance of the whole film, and probably one of the most standout performances in any Hitchcock film, is Barbara Lee Hunt as Brenda Blaney. I think she is absolutely insanely incredible in this film. She's only in three really short scenes before the rape and murder scene. And in that time, she just creates this whole presence so that when the murder scene comes, like you say, Chris, it's devastating and it's harrowing because we really care about, up to now, one of the only decent characters that we know in the film. Even from the moment when he says she's kind of had enough and she just wants him to leave and he's a real nuisance and he's a real pest and he comes in all the time. And then that moment where he says, "I like you," and she kind of opens her eyes and slowly looks up at him, and then she starts to sit back and becomes a lot more rigid, and you can see the fear, and you're with her. You're with her for the whole scene. Mm-hmm. You totally are with her the whole time. She's amazing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a really well-done scene. It's a very difficult watch, right? Because there's not a whole lot of punches that are pulled in here. And I think it's handled with respect. And, like, I don't feel that it's a misogynistic scene because there's, like, it's not, like, championing the man in this, right? It's putting the horror on the situation. And there are men out there who murder women. Like, I mean, that happens, right? I mean, this is the second time I've mentioned it recently, but if you go back to our Young and Innocent episode, like, I didn't have a problem with the blackface in Young and Innocent because entertainers in that time, they did that, right? And it's a portrayal of what happened at that time, and that's what bands did. I don't know why that they did it, but they did it, right? So it's not glorifying the action. It's not glorifying the behavior. It's showing you how difficult this situation can be and how gruesome and horrifying the situation is. Like, the only other time that this has been respectfully portrayed on screen, I think, is in Fincher's Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. You know, like, it's horrifying when you get to that scene.
Yeah, I mean, I think the only... There is the sequence where you follow Russ because he realizes that, you know, his typing's gone, and you have what is basically the potato truck scene.
Right.
And that, I think, is one of the only times when you are forced to not sympathise with, but, you know, you are watching him try to get away with murdering. I believe it's Babs he's put in the back. That entire scene, and it's tense, and you're almost encouraged to go, "Oh, I wonder if he's going to find it. I wonder if he's going to get it. I wonder if he's going to..." That sort of thing. When logically you'd be like, "No, I really don't want you to find this. I want you to get caught because you are a psychopathic murderer."
This is the other weird thing. So, like, I like this movie. There's a lot of really good stuff in it. But this potato sequence, the humor in it really threw me off. Because there's really nothing else like it in this movie. There's not a lot of funny stuff going on in this movie. So when he's getting, like, kicked in the face by the corpse, you know, and he's like, potatoes are dropping out of the vehicle and stuff, like, I get the feeling that he's almost done this scene like we're supposed to be rooting for Rusk in this instance, right? Where it's one of those tension sequences where it's like, well, we don't want Rusk to get caught because he's now our protagonist for this section of the film.
Yeah, I guess it's like the psycho effect, isn't it? Of that, the whole Norman cleaning the motel room and the shower was to kind of switch our sympathies towards him, but I don't know. It doesn't quite work here, but maybe that's because it comes too late in the movie, or maybe because at the point in Psycho when it happens, we don't know Norman is the killer yet, or we're not supposed to know that Norman is the killer yet, whereas we know that Rusk is the killer.
Yeah.
There's really interesting footage, actually, of Hitchcock. Actually, that is one of the other things I do find interesting about this film, is that this is one of the only films, other than Family Plot, where there's a lot of footage. I mean, it's all on YouTube and it's on the making of directory, where there's actual footage of Hitchcock directing the film. which I think is a really interesting thing because we don't get that. We haven't had that with a lot of his earlier stuff. But there's footage where Hitchcock's talking about the build-up. An interviewer asks him, what scenes are you looking forward to filming? And he specifically says the potato truck scene as a scene that he's really looking forward to doing. And he says, I think it'll be really funny. And the interviewer says, well, it doesn't sound very funny. And Hitchcock says, well, you clearly don't know dead bodies if you don't think they're funny.
The thing that the worst part of the potato truck sequence that got me was him having to break the corpse's fingers,
yeah,
to get the lapel pin out of her fingers, and that was hard to watch. But yeah, it is a little bit situation comedy, isn't it? Right?
Yeah.
I don't know. It feels so out of place in the movie. Like, I don't know any other movie, maybe, but it just in this one, it's just like, oh, this is just weird at this time in the film. So. I don't know. Again, I think I'll surprise you with my rating when I give it, because it's not greater than the sum of its parts. Its parts are all great, but together it's just weird.
Is it possibly, I don't know, but is it possibly just to maybe give Rusk a little bit more screen time? Because I suppose up to now, we haven't actually seen a lot of him.
I don't have a problem with the scene. I have a problem with the humor.
Mm.
You know, like, it's the foot in the face. It's yeah. It's just that, maybe it's just even, like, that one thing for me. Like, just getting the foot in the face, and it's like, I don't want to be laughing right now.
Yeah.
You know, like, in this sequence. Body. Yeah, because this is such a horrific thing that's just happened, you know? So I don't know.
Do you think,
just,
Brandon,
that
you would rather it had been approached as just an out-and-out horror scene?
100%. 100%. Absolutely, I would have. Had he just played it straight, played the tension, I would have been... Like, because in Psycho, it's not funny when Norman is going through that sequence. And that's a very good comparison. Because in that sequence, I remember when we talked about Psycho, I'm like, what's wrong with me? Because I'm rooting for Norman in this. But, you know, one thing I don't even think I realized when I talked about the film that you just mentioned is the first time you see that movie, you don't know that Norman's the killer. But you know that Rusk is the killer here. So there is that distance when that stuff's happening to Norman, because you just think he's trying to protect his mom at that time, the first time you see the film. So if it had been played straight up, it would have been perfect for me, I think. I wouldn't have had a problem with it at all, because there's some great tension in it, you know? So, Michael, is there any other sequences in the film that you want to talk about that we haven't touched on yet?
Oh, any sequences?
Or anything that's really stand out for you that elevates this to your number two spot?
Something I do really love about this film, and something that I think goes underappreciated in a lot of Hitchcock's films, particularly later films, is I love the score by Ron Goodwin. I think kind of any Hitchcock score that wasn't done by Bernard Herrmann, people just kind of tend to forget. But I think the music in this film is great. It feels, to kind of misquote Blackmail, there's something very British about it, which I really love. But I think it's a real... fantastic score, and again, not without its controversies, because originally, you can hear it in the making of documentary, originally Henry Mancini recorded the score for Frenzy, and they play a sample of it in the making of documentary, and it's fantastic. It's really good, and it's really quite scary. I don't know why Hitchcock didn't go with it. Apparently his criticism of it was that it was trying to be too much like a Herrmann soundtrack. So he went with Ron Goodwin instead, but that's a big gamble, actually, because he really could have... Because Mancini's score was so good, it could have really backfired by firing him and getting somebody else, but I don't think it does. I think that the music by Ron Goodwin is really, really strong.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I noticed going through the film that there's some pretty incredible sequences as well. So... the only other sequence that I want to mention is just briefly, there's not a whole lot to talk about, but when Rusk is taking Barb upstairs.
Oh, yeah.
You know, there's that long sequence going up the steps, and then they pass the camera, and then he just slowly takes it out. There's a really awkward cut that's like kind of a cut that's trying to hide something when it gets onto the street. But, I mean, that whole sequence is very, very filled with tension, so... when the camera's just going up the stairs backwards.
I go there all the time. I go to that location now in real life is a restaurant. It's like a three-story restaurant in Covent Garden. Mm-hmm. And I deliberately went upstairs to the first floor and asked about like the price of coffee, but just so I could go up those stairs. I wasn't interested in the coffee at all. I just wanted to go up those stairs. But I don't think they're the actual stairs in the film. I think the stairs in the film were a studio, a soundstage.
Maybe that's why they had the cuts and the awkward cuts.
Yeah, that is. That was, possibly. They have the guy with the sack of potatoes that wipes the screen. And that goes from the soundstage to the real location. But it was enough for me just to climb those stairs.
Tom, anything else you want to talk about before we sign off?
Just a quick point that over the decades of all the Hitchcock films we've covered, there's always been an issue of accessibility to the films. How do the modern film goers get a hold of these films? So lately with the more modern films, there's a lot of ways to get hold of them. Quickly here, I rented this on Amazon for $5. Where did each of you, how did you watch this film?
So I out of that awesome set that I just recently got that I was talking about, so I got it on Blu-ray now. That's how I watched it. Looked gorgeous. Looked just beautiful, beautiful transfer.
Michael?
I have the DVD. I got the DVD a long, long time ago, kind of when DVDs were at their height of popularity.
Yeah, I had the DVD. I bought a nice box set of the DVDs and just recently upgraded to Blu-ray, so it's basically the same set, just the Blu-ray version.
Same. I got the DVD back when, dinosaurs roamed the earth. So, yeah.
Well, I think that's about covers the film. I think we've done a good job. I think we've. I think it's time for us to give our ratings. So, Michael, how many bags of potatoes out of 5 do you give this movie?
I'm going to give it 5 bags of potatoes.
Ooh,
I might even give it 5 margaritas.
Excellent. Tom, how many bags of potatoes will you give this?
I'm giving it 4 out of 5. I enjoyed it, nice. But yeah, there's a lot of things about the film that are stopping me from accessing it and stopping me from enjoying it as much as I could.
Mm-hmm. Chris, how about you?
I will give it 4.5 bags of potatoes. 4.5 Ooh. Bags of spuds.
Wow, excellent, right on. So, if I was giving half ratings, I would give it 3.5. So, I enjoyed it, but there's a lot, I think, that makes the film awkward. But as I don't give half ratings, I'm going to give it a 4, because it is, it's not a 3. Like, it's better than an average film. Like, there's a lot of really, really great stuff in this. So I'm going to give it a 4. That's what I'll give it. So I don't think I popped it into my rankings here, but this is going to be kind of mid-tier for me, I think. I mean, it's tough because Hitchcock has got so many great films. Like, I gave Topaz a 4. If Roland Emmerich, you know, director of 2012 and Independence Day, if this was actually a Roland Emmerich film, then it'd be like a 4 is a really strong rating, right? But it's like, it's bizarre that 4 feels like a weak rating for Hitchcock, you know? It's like, it's an okay mid-tier, it's just a 4. It's just a 4. That's all I'm going to give this one. But it's just got so many 5-star ones, right? So it's kind of funny. Anyways, excellent. Michael, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate you reached out to us over a year ago when we were getting all ramped up with all of our Alfred Hitchcock Presents. You said, I want to be on for Frenzy. Please have me on. And I said, absolutely, we'll do it in April. And then now here we are 12 months later doing it in that April.
And you kept me in suspense that whole time. It was very fitting.
Yes, excellent. Now, if you just hand me your plate, you've done your alley cat, I've got for you the most lovely dessert of candied prairie oysters for you to try and finish your... Oh, Tom! We can't forget Tom.
You don't want to know.
Google it. Excellent. Michael, tell us once again, where can people find you? Tell us what your podcast, where they can find that, and where they can find you online on the social medias.
So my podcast is called Twice Nightly, the podcast. It's available on all podcast platforms, and you can pretty much find me on any social media platform at Twice Nightly, the podcast. Just search it, and you'll find us.
You know where to find Tom and Chris and I. We're all in the same usual places. Thank you so much to Jason Cullimore for creating our wonderful theme music. We love it, and it's great, and we've already given it wild ravings right at the beginning of the show, and you'll get to hear it again. Thank you so much to the Fandom Podcast Network for hosting our show. You can find our episodes in their feed as well as our own independent feed. And don't forget to check out Annie and Catherine's Good Evening, an Alfred Hitchcock Presents podcast, where they go over all of Hitch's television episodes on his shows. That's all we got for you this month, until next month when we cover his final film, Family Plot. Good evening.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Good evening. Good evening.